Fields in the digit space. And so what we derived is that there are sort of two useful pictures of the digit space, both which come in handy. The standard one that is actually most used in cosmology is where you think of the digit space as a flat expanding universe, spatially flat. And a universe, something like this, where those constant T surfaces cover the center space in that manner. And then this surface, T equals minus infinity, is actually just this null surface here. And then there's the actual coordinate system, the static coordinate system, that an observer in the sitter space actually perceives, this region here, often called the causal or the static patch. And you can sort of foliate that system like this, so on, where the coordinates that cover that region take this form. And this is a sort of, this is a spherical system of coordinates. And this this surface here is the horizon, which is located at r is h minus 1, which is, the surface is really null actually at the horizon, because what happens is at that point f of r vanishes, because it's r squared minus h squared, indicating that when this vanishes, it's like in the horizon of a black hole, it's indicating it's really a null surface. And it's a spherical surface whose area is 4 pi r squared, so that's h minus 2. And associated with that area, there is an entropy, which is 1 over 4g a, or in the way I prefer to do it is in terms of reduced Planck units, where m Planck squared is 1 over 8 pi g, and so that this is really 2 pi a m Planck squared, and so the area is 8 pi squared m Planck squared. So the entropy is 8 pi squared m Planck squared over h squared. So that's the entropy of the sitter space. And we also derive the temperature, h over 2 pi, which is the temperature as seen by an observer in the sitter space. So one way of saying that is that the vacuum, as I've said before, the vacuum, the Bunch-Davis vacuum, which is the vacuum annihilated by the annihilation operators in the flat slicing basis. That's the one where we wrote the fields phi in this way, ak uk ik dot x plus emission conjugate, and the modes uk, you add an over 1 over a eta there, whereas uk look like this. So that in the flat slicing, the vacuum, which are defined on these surfaces here, when you coarse grain it, it's kind of coarse graining, where basically you say, well, if you go into the static slicing, then the original vacuum was defined on a surface that went like that. But of course, now your coordinate system only covers this region, and so you're throwing away all that information. And so you're essentially tracing over that information. You can't measure anything. And in quantum mechanics, when you do a trace, when you're throwing away information like that, you're doing a trace over a density matrix. So you take the original pure, the density matrix of the Bunch-Davis vacuum, which is a pure state, your state satisfies trace rho is 1, trace rho squared is 1. This is just normalization, and that makes it a pure state. But the state as seen by an observer in the static patch, so the density matrix for the observer, is really the trace of that over the modes that lie outside the horizon. So we're literally integrating out all this information out here because we can't measure it. We want the effective state in there. But the fact that what we derive is really, we see when we do that at the level of the fields, we see that the spectrum is really thermal, tells you that whatever that is, although we haven't explicitly done that trace, we kind of know indirectly the answer must be a thermal spectrum where beta is normal, 1 over k Boltzmann t, and t k Boltzmann t is really h over 2 pi. Now, this Hamiltonian here, we have to use the correct Hamiltonian associated with the observer in the static patch. Now, how do you construct that guy? So this guy must be the generator of the time-like killing vector you have in that patch. And let me just tell you how to construct it. You don't often see it done explicitly. So remember that what we're working with is a massless scalar field, which in an arbitrary coordinate system, the action from massless scalar field just looks like this. So let's put this into the coordinate system that covers the static patch in De Sitter. So root minus g is actually quite simple, like for Schwarzschild. The f of r and the 1 over f of r cancel. So root minus g is just r squared sine squared theta, because this guy is really d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. So that's just as normal as you would have normal in just going to spherical coordinates in Minkowski space. And so all the non-trivial information is in this inverse metric here. So the action is dr dt d theta d phi r squared sine squared theta. And then if we work it out, basically we're inversing the metric. So this metric is diagonal, so it's easy to inverse. So we're going to get a 1 over f in the t direction with an overall sign that cancels that sign. D phi dt squared. We're going to get an f in the r direction. 1 over f is an f. And then we have the angular piece, which is just like normal. And I'll just write that as grad on the S2, where the notation is such that this is the Laplacian. It's not the Laplacian, it's the covariant derivative defined on the two-sphere of the spherical slicing, on the unit-dimensional two-sphere. So that's the action for our massless scalar written in the coordinate system that an observer would actually see, that covers the observer's region. And so in some sense, this is the natural way to write the action for an observer in De Sitter space. It's not the way we do it on a daily basis, but we actually do when we do cosmological perturbation theory is we solve for far more than we can ever see. We solve things on the flat slicing because it's mathematically easier to do that, even though most of that information, well, not most of it, but half of that information we can't see. But this is how we would really do it if we were sort of quantizing things in terms of what we can actually see. And so to construct the Hamiltonian, you follow the standard route that you define the momentum conjugate in this system as the variation of the Lagrangian with respect to d phi dt. And And this is only slightly non-trivial because of the measure that comes out. That piece is over all there. But also you have the 1 over f of r. And if I put a half in front of everything, then that comes out as just a single d phi dt. So here's a classic thing on a closed space. The momentum conjugate is no longer just the velocity of the field. Here it goes like the velocity times 1 over this function f of r. And in fact, of course, as you go near the horizon, f of r is getting smaller. So for a fixed velocity, the momentum is getting larger. Or is more accurate, really, for a fixed momentum, the velocity gets smaller as you go towards the horizon. And it's this guy which sets the canonical commutation relations up on an equal time surface. So you would quantize in this region. In this sense, so that at equal times, this is I times the natural delta function between, so it's really, I guess I can write it out explicitly, it's something like a product of delta functions, r minus r prime, delta theta minus theta prime, delta phi minus phi prime. So that's how you would quantize the system. This is the momentum conjugate. And so the Hamiltonian is defined in the normal sense that the Hamiltonian is really the Hamiltonian density, which is the guy whose integral over the volume is the Hamiltonian, is the momenta times the field derivative d phi dt minus the Lagrangian, just the standard formula. And then what you do is the standard trick of you, the Lagrangian starts out as a function of the field and the velocity of the field, and then you rewrite that in terms of the momenta. So the Hamiltonian density is then pi times d phi dt, which we can write as f of r over r squared sine squared theta pi. So I'm just rewriting d phi dt back in terms of pi, inverting that equation. And then minus the Lagrangian, so it's minus r squared sine squared theta. And then, as usual, we'll have exactly one half contribution from here. The half phi dot squared will basically give an identical piece, which is multiplied by a half. And so it overall halves the kinetic term, just as is standard. And then these guys, the gradient terms, they're negative in the Lagrangian. They come in as positive in the Hamiltonian. And so you get f of r d phi dr squared with an overall half plus 1 over r squared grad s2 phi squared. So the energy, what we really mean by the energy in the static patch, is the integral of the Hamiltonian density over dr d theta d phi. Yep.
Square root of minus g is r squared sine of the sine squared.
That's right, that's true. Sorry. Yes, it's r squared. Is that right? I'm thinking of a 3-sphere. It's a 2-sphere we're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. You're right. Sine theta. Sorry, I'm working the wrong number of dimensions there. So putting that together, you have r squared sine theta. I can take that thing overall out. F of r pi squared over 2. And then you double this off to the 4 sine theta squared. And then plus f of r pi pi dr squared plus 1 over r squared right s2 phi squared. So that's what we mean by the Hamiltonian, the integral of the Hamiltonian density over the static region, over these coordinates, the static region. But of course, we should be careful here over the range of limits of integration. So phi is as normal 0 to 2 pi. Theta is normal to pi. But r only goes from 0 to h minus 1. Because these coordinates only cover the region for r less than h minus 1. Because when we hit r as h, f actually vanishes. And then when we go through it, then the f changes sign, which is just demonstrating that there is horizon there. So this is the quantity that comes in the thermal factor like that when we say that the effective density matrix is up to a normalization, z inverse e to the minus beta h static. And the notation is such that z is the partition function, which is defined in the normal way, where this trace is now over the degrees of freedom inside the horizon. Okay, so this fact that an observer in the theater sees a finite temperature has physical implications. It means that if you want to understand the physics inside your horizon, then you really want to be doing finite temperature quantum field theory, because the temperature has an effect. So the picture, the correspondence, so often called the de Sitter complementarity between the flat slicing picture and the observer picture, says that in order to get the physics correct as an observer and get the physics in the static slicing correct, if I'm really in vacuum, then I need to realize that I'm doing quantum field theory in a theory where this is the Hamiltonian, but I'm doing it at finite temperature. Because the vacuum state on the global slicing is actually a thermal state in the static slicing. And there's physics in that. Of course, if you're at finite temperature, you have thermal fluctuations. So let's imagine thinking about the following situation. Let's imagine a scalar field now, which actually has a potential as well. And let's imagine the potential for that scalar looks something like this. So a classic sort of form where we've got two different minima. And suppose you start out here as your classical solution, and you start out in this vacuum. So here we've got effectively two vacuum states, two minima, where the field can sit, which are both classically stable. It's natural to be stuck at that minima. Now, we know in quantum mechanics that if you have a situation like this, of course, it's energetically forbidden if you start here at rest to ever get here. There's no solution that can ever get it down here, because it's just energetically forbidden, because you have to get all the way up here before you can roll down again classically. Quantum mechanically, you know, of course, that you can actually tunnel through. What's one of the features of quantum mechanics? You can make it through by a tunneling process. But if you're at finite temperature, there's another way you can tunnel, because you can have thermal fluctuations. So if you think about the physics of this system, so then the Hamiltonian would basically be this, the Hamiltonian for the massless scalar field, plus the potential term. That's the Hamiltonian we should think about. But we're at finite temperature, so all the time there's going to be fluctuations, thermal fluctuations, going on around that field because of the finite temperature effect. And every so often, there's going to be a big enough fluctuation that can fluctuate all the way up to the top of the potential because of the temperature effect. And when you get there, you can then roll down along the other side. And so that process is called thermal tunneling, or thermally activated tunneling. And it's easy to give a crude estimate of the rate of that tunneling process, because basically you just think about what you do when you do chemistry and you have, say, activation energies. If you were thinking, if this was the energy we were plotting, then if we say there's an energy difference between this minima and the maxima here, delta E, then the tunneling rate would just go like E to the minus delta E over kT. That would be the standard answer you would get in a say, a chemical system where this thing would be called the activation energy. So what this is saying is that the thermal fluctuations allow for an exponentially suppressed probability to jump, to fluctuate up to the top, so that you can then roll over classically and come down to the bottom. And that rate in the exponential, it doesn't depend on the energy here. It only depends on the energy difference between the minima here and the maxima. Because the hard thing, the only hard thing, is to get up to the top. But once you've got to the top, then you can roll down classically to the bottom, and that's energetically allowed. So that's basically what the thermally activated tunneling rate is. Now, this energy here is really this guy, the static energy that you have to calculate, integrated over static patch horizon. But we can do a very quick calculation of actually how that works out. It's basically, we use the fact that delta E is T delta S, where S is the entropy difference between the bottom and the top. So in other words, the tunneling rate, let me call it lambda, or is it gamma, tunneling rate, goes like E to the minus delta S, where delta S is the entropy difference between the top and the bottom. Now, the entropy in De Sitter space we know is given by 8 pi squared and Planck squared over h squared. So how is it that the entropy is changing when you go from the bottom to the top? Well, if the field is located here, the value of the potential is smaller. Here it's larger. Now, Friedmann's equation tells you that the Hubble constant, h squared, is 1 over 3 m Planck squared, in other words, it's 8 pi g over 3, multiplied by, in general, it's something like the kinetic term for the scalar field plus the potential energy. So when you tunnel up from the bottom to the top and you include gravity, if you change the value of the potential of the scalar and that potential sources gravity itself, you're effectively changing the value of the cosmological constant. Therefore, you'll change the effective value of the Hubble constant. If you change the value of the Hubble constant, you'll also change the value of the entropy. So in this process, there is a different entropy here than there is here. We can calculate that entropy difference very simply by saying we can write it that the change in the entropy is 8 pi squared and Planck squared over h cubed, and there'll be a minus 2, so it's minus 16 times the change in the Hubble constant from going to the bottom to the top. And the change in the Hubble constant can be determined from this equation. Basically, we're looking at the difference of two solutions which are both at rest, but the value of the Hubble will change at the bottom at the top because the value of the potential changes. So from here, you'll get that 2h delta h is 1 over 3 m Planck squared times the change in the potential energy density, of course, between the bottom and the top. That's the potential energy of the scalar field. So we just plug that formula into here. We get that delta s ends up being, we put it together, So we have an overall 8 pi squared m Planck squared divided by h to the 4 times h delta h, 2h delta h, which is 1 over 3 m Planck squared delta v. And combining that, we get minus 8 pi squared m Planck squared divided by, so the m Planck squareds cancel. We get 1 over 8 pi squared 3 h to the 4 times the change in the potential energy. Now, when the larger the value of h, the smaller the entropy is. The smaller the value of h, the larger the entropy is. So the fact that entropy wants to increase in a normal situation is the statement that h wants to decrease in a normal situation. The fact that this process is more or less forbidden is, of course, what you're actually doing is going the wrong way. You're trying to decrease the entropy to come up to the top because you're increasing the value of h. And that's why it's an exponentially forbidden process, because you're going the wrong way. The value of h down here, because the potential is smaller, the value of h is smaller, therefore the entropy is bigger. Therefore, this is a preferred, thermodynamically preferred configuration to that one. But nevertheless, even though this is disfavored thermodynamically, there's some probability to fluctuate up to the top. And so that rate is given by minus, so we want delta V, so the rate is exponentially suppressed by the value of the potential at the top minus the value of the potential at the bottom, 8 pi squared over 3 h to the 4.
Which coefficient?
For the rate. So for the tunneling rate here, you've got proportional to e to the something.
And yeah.
You've got an equivalence of quality.
So tunneling rates always go like e over kt, right? And then I'm just saying that the delta e is TdS. So that's basically the same if I ignore the Boltzmann constant. Then that's the same as the change of the exponential of the change in the entropy.
Okay, but how did you get the coefficient out the front of the exponential? As in rate equals e to the.
Oh, how do you determine what's in front here?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a hard calculation. Yeah, that we can't get from this simple analysis. Okay, so you have to do this prefactor here is quite hard to get. You have to do. You can do it in a path integral way, and it's basically a sort of comes from a determinant path integral way, a one loop calculation in path integral. So it's quite hard to get that. So, but this thing, the dependence, the prefactor is always a subdominant effect in the overall exponential suppression, basically. So we'll often in practice people will write down, well, the rate is basically the exponential of this thing, because this thing gives the main suppression factor. It comes from the thermodynamic thing. This thing is just some function of the parameters, but it's not strongly suppressed. Okay, so there is a prefactor here that is kind of hard to calculate. So really, I'm only saying that the tunneling rate is proportional to that fact. So this is the way round you'd expect. The larger you make the top of the potential, the harder it is to thermally tunnel up, and so the smaller the rate will be. It get exponentially suppressed. Similarly, the lower you make the bottom, the easier it will be to tunnel. So this tunneling process actually goes by another name. It's called the Hawking-Moss tunneling, and is associated with something called the Hawking-Moss instanton. And the instanton means the Euclidean solution of the equations of motion that actually allows you to do that. And so this situation is kind of funny in a sense that if you think about the two pictures of De Sitter, what you're saying is that in the observer's region, then they're living at finite temperature, and there's some value of the field, phi, on a given surface, where, say, it's down here initially, phi 0. And then what's happening is that at some time, you start out at phi 0, and then because of some thermal fluctuation, the field configuration over that entire horizon can tunnel up to the top and then roll down classically. So essentially, the whole region of this space sort of tunnels to the top solution by a gigantic thermal fluctuation, which the whole field across the horizon basically hits phi 1. So it's phi 0 initially, and then at some slightly later time, it becomes phi 1 over the whole thing. And then you classically roll down to phi 2 with some subsequent dynamics. Now, that what's happening is kind of weird because in this picture, it's a finite temperature effect. But the physics must be the same. I mean, the outcome must be the same if we work in the flat slicing here. Now, when you work in the flat slicing, there is no temperature. There is no temperature with flat slicing observer. There you're in vacuum. There are no thermal fluctuations. Nevertheless, this process, this Hawking-Moss tunneling process, must still occur. So in that picture, what it is, it's purely quantum mechanical effect. It's a quantum mechanical tunneling effect. But in the observer region, it's a consequence of thermal tunneling. You can still do it in flat slicing. You can still do a calculation that shows the existence of this tunneling process, but it's nothing to do with finite temperature. It's purely quantum mechanical effect. So this shows that there is actually physics related to the fact that you're at finite temperature. Okay, it's not just some weird artifact, or I don't know how to define particles. If I use this definition, it looks like I'm at finite temperature, but I'm not really at finite temperature. That's not true. You really are at finite temperature in the observer patch, and there's physics associated with that, that you can have thermal fluctuations, essentially. And that's made clear by tunneling processes like this. Okay, so... So one other thing I want to finish off is to understand a slightly peculiar feature of these quantum fields under Sitter, that it's going to turn out for cosmology is that basically these quantum fluctuations in this scalar field are the fluctuations that essentially source the metric fluctuations and then eventually source matter fluctuations, and those create the little fluctuations that eventually grow by gravitational instability to set up the growth of structure and determine the distribution of galaxies and so on. And there's a kind of weird feature of this that we start out with quantum fluctuations. But then somehow out of that, we get a classical universe. So the statement is that when we look out in the sky now, we look at the distribution of galaxies, that distribution we see right now is determined from a fundamental quantum probability distribution, the calculation of which we're doing during inflation. So something weird goes on. How is it that these quantum fluctuations give rise to the classical universe that we see today? And this the way this occurs is through a process of squeezing. What we're dealing with is squeezed quantum states. And this arises because of the particle production. The particle production actually creates the squeezing of the state, and the squeezing of the state makes it look more classical. So to understand how that occurs, let's think for a second how classical physics arises from quantum physics. So one thing we know is the different one difference between classical and quantum is all encoded, obviously, in Planck's constant. As Planck's constant goes to zero, then naively we expect quantum physics to recover classical. And so that's made apparent by saying, well, we know in the quantum case that the position of fields and the momenta of the fields don't commute. And if we'd reintroduced where Planck's constant sat, it would be sat there. Just as the position of a particle and a momentum of a particle don't commute, h-bar sits on the right-hand side there. Now, as h-bar goes to zero, as you become more classical, basically you're going in the limit in which everything commutes again. So the difference between a quantum field and a classical field is that classical fields commute. The fields of momenta commute. You can go into states in which you can simultaneously know the field and its momenta, where quantum mechanically you can only ever know either the field or the momenta of the field or some combination of those two things. Now this shows up in... So one way of saying this is if we think about the quantity called the Whiteman function. Well, let me just do it for T. Which is the expectation value of the field at a given time times the expectation value times the field at another time. This is the fundamental quantum correlator that for a free field is enough to specify essentially the whole theory, because if the theory is free, if you know the two-point function, you know all the endpoint functions in terms of products of the two-point functions. So in some sense, knowing the vacuum expectation value of this basically determines everything about free field theories. And one of the important properties of this quantity, of course, is that it's not true that if we change the order, we wouldn't get the same thing. That's because, in general, fields at different times don't commute. At the same time, they always commute, because that's in the definition of commutation relations. But at different times, in general, the field does not commute with itself at a different time. That's because we know the field doesn't commute with its own momenta. When we evolve the field to some later time, we're basically integrating, given some initial value of the field and some initial value of the momenta. We need to know both of those things to get the field at a later time. So implicit, if t prime is in the future of t, to know phi x prime at t prime, we would need to know both phi x of t and pi x of t to solve the equations of motion. Therefore, this guy depends on phi x of t and pi x of t, because we need both initial conditions to solve the equations of motion. But since phi and pi don't commute, in general, phi won't commute with itself at different times. And that failure of commutivity is represented by the presence of a h-bar on the right-hand side. Furthermore, if you take the expectation value of this quantity, in general, that's not zero. So let's compute the expectation value. But in the following situation, let's go back to the particle creation picture, where we have a field which we write in terms of a set of in-mode functions in k plus a k dagger, u in k star, e to the I k dot x, e to the minus I k dot x. And let's imagine the situation whereby, because of particle creation, u in k is some Bogoliubov transform of the outmodes which actually the natural modes that define the state of a system at late time. So we're going back to this situation where we have a well-defined in state, a well-defined out state, and then we have particle creation in between. And so the in mode is the mode that's WKB-like at early times, and the out mode is the mode that's WKB-like with positive energy at late times. But in general, this state, because of the particle creation, will evolve into a superposition of those two things. Now, these Bogoliubov coefficients, one thing we know they have to satisfy is the normalization condition, mod A alpha k squared minus mod beta k squared is unity. Now, where this normalization condition came from was actually demanding, it basically came from the Klein-Gordon inner product, demanding that the modes satisfy the Wronskian condition. And where did that condition come from? It came from requiring that this field satisfied its commutation relations. Equal time commutation relations. So this condition here, satisfied by the Bogoliubov coefficients, is intimately tied with the canonical quantization condition. That's where it comes from. But that also tells you that secretly, if we of course we've been working with H bar as one, but if we put it back in some rough sense, there is really a H bar sitting on the right hand side there. We could have defined it that way. So that tells us that we know when we go in the classical limit, H bar gets small. Effectively, that's what the classical limit should arise from. But as H bar gets small, we go equivalently going in a limit where alpha k is approximately mod beta k. So turning that round, if we're at finite value, if we set H bar to 1, how can we see the classical limit coming out from this relationship? Well, we know in the classical limit, it must be true that alpha k is approximately beta k, but we still have to satisfy this condition for actual finite H bar. So the only way these two statements can be consistent is if beta k is much greater than 1. So when you're in that region where the beta k is much bigger than 1, then, of course, this statement does indeed give rise to mod alpha k is approximately mod beta k. And that's equivalent to the statement that I could ignore this 1 on the right-hand side, which is equivalent to the statement that you can basically, you're taking h bar to 0 and you're going in a kind of classical limit. Yeah?
So can you just explain again why that 1, that alpha k squared minus beta k squared is 1, but then becomes h bar?
So what I'm saying is that this, where we got this formula from was demanding that these modes satisfy the Wronskian condition. That's where it derives from. It's basically the preserving the norm of the wave function under the evolution. So you could, you know, any this thing can evolve from here to some superposition of these guys, but the norm of the wave function is preserved. So the statement the norm is preserved is this condition, which comes from here. But the way we derive this, why do we have that relationship, is because really we're writing the field in this thing. And then we demanded that the field satisfies its commutation relations. And then if the A's satisfy their usual canonical commutation relations, AK with AK prime dagger, is 2 pi cubed times the delta function, the standard thing, then that forced the U's to satisfy that relationship. So what I'm saying is then that this relationship comes from the commutation relation. In which, but in the commutation relation, there's a h bar sitting here. And if h bar was 0, this would be 0. So in the classical limit, you could have this being 0. and therefore this would be 0. Make sense? So equivalently, it's saying that the betas have to be much larger than unity. But since the interpretation of the beta, nk is mod beta squared, is the number of particles you've created in per unit volume, per range of k. In other words, the actual number per unit volume you integrate over some range of k. These are the analogs of occupation numbers. So when we create particles, we're also increasing the occupation numbers of a given particle state. And so, as always in quantum mechanics, the classical limit is really obtained in the limit in which the occupation numbers, the quantized numbers, become large. Because it's in that limit that the quantized numbers, for large values of those numbers, you can think of them as continuous quantities, and that's always the limit in which you recover a classical behavior in your system. So if you create a large number of particles, your system, by this argument, your system will become more classical. That's the limit. And that's precisely what occurs in inflation when the modes get stretched outside the horizon. The WKB approximation doesn't break down mildly. It breaks down order one. It just becomes completely invalid. And so it's always true in some sense in that region that you're going to a very classical limit where you have essentially no notion of particles, which is in some sense equivalent to saying you've produced lots of particles because WKB is completely broken down. So that's also a classical limit. So to make this clear how this works, what's happening, if mod beta is proportional to mod alpha, then I can parameterize that statement by basically saying, in this limit, it's true that alpha k must be beta k up to a phase if alpha k is approximately mod beta k, which is true when these guys are much bigger than unity. But when that's true, the in-mode function is basically proportional to beta k uk plus e to the I delta k uk star. Now, the key point is that this guy comes out the front. If I look at the complex conjugate of this, then I get beta k star uk star plus e to the minus delta k uk. But I can rewrite that as beta k star over beta k e to the minus 2i delta k times uk. This ratio, of course, is just a phase. And this is just a phase. So what we're saying, in the limit where you have many particles produced, the complex conjugate of the wave function is always just proportional up to a phase, and as we know, phases are basically always irrelevant to the original wave function. So in some sense, if I can ignore that phase, let's just set it to 1, what we're saying is that the original complex wave function is effectively becoming real in that limit because its complex conjugate is related to itself, and there's some kind of halving in the number of degrees of freedom in the system. So the implication of that is let's think about the Whiteman function, this quantity which we've defined is basically the expectation value of the product of fields at different times That's our representation of the field. So we know if we apply the field on the vacuum, the A annihilates the vacuum, so the only bit that comes out non-zero is the A dagger piece. And similarly, on the left, we have the Hermitian conjugate of that statement. So putting those two together, it follows that W plus XT, X prime T prime, is going to be, you'll start with a double integral . You then have an expectation value of AK, AK prime dagger, 0. You'll then have mode function UK evaluated at time t, mode function U in K star evaluated at t prime, and then E to the I K dot X minus X prime. K dot X minus I K prime dot X prime. But the expectation value, this thing here, just gives me a delta function, 2 pi cubed times a delta function, that sets k equal to k prime. That delta function gets rid of one of the momenta integrals. And so we infer that the correlation function, the two-point correlation function, otherwise known as the Whiteman function, is actually just integral to 3k over 2 pi cubed, uk, unk, a t, unk star, t prime, and then e to the I k dot x minus x prime. So if we think about what is the difference then, between the commutation of two fields, the expectation value of the commutator in the vacuum, then between two fields at different points in space and different points in time, this quantity, being the expectation value of the products and then difference in the different order, is just going to be equal to the Whiteman function in the original order minus the Whiteman function with the x switch to x prime and the t switch to t prime, because all we've done is switch the order. Now, we can just evaluate that simply from here. Now, as always with momenta integrals, if I switch x and x prime, this exponent switches. But I can also switch the dummy integral variable k to minus k prime. And if these modes only depend on the modulus of k, then nothing else changes. And so I can keep it with the same exponent. So this difference then, the only difference is the time part. Which ends up being this combination here. So what this shows you is the whole failure for the fields that commute is encoded in the fact that U is different than U star, because the only difference between this piece and this piece is that here we have the field U evaluated at T and U star evaluated at T prime, whereas here it's U evaluated at T and U star, U T prime and U star evaluated at T. But then this statement, what it shows you is that in some limit, when you have many particles, the complex conjugate of the wave function is just directly proportional to the original wave function. Therefore, in that limit, it follows that this combination must be zero. Because if we plugged it in, the U star would just have, you'd have an overall factor of beta k star of a beta k e to the minus 2i delta k. So even if the phase is not zero, nevertheless it just comes out overall multiplicatively, and then you get uk in t uk in t prime minus the same thing. And that's approximately zero. So that's what we mean by things becoming classical. Well, it's what we mean in this cosmological context by things becoming classical. There is a limit in which you create many particles, you occupy the states a large amount, the wave functions, complex quantity of the wave functions come proportional to the wave functions, and that's precisely the limit in which then fields commute. But fields commuting is, that's precisely taking away the quantum aspects of field theory. As soon as you go into the limit where the quantum fields commute, then you're going into a limit where it becomes classical field theory. Now, this was all phrased in the standard Bogoliubov picture, where you still can talk about in and out states. What happens if you don't have an in and out state, as you do in De Sitter space? Well, we can still make the argument in De Sitter space and it's basically tied to the behavior of the positive frequency modes in De Sitter space. That if you remember, the exact solution ends up being minus h eta 1 minus I over k eta e to the minus I k eta. That's the exact solution for the positive frequency mode. And at high, for k eta much bigger than 1, you're in the WKB regime where it's highly oscillatory. Should put the normalization in as well. And in that region, this guy is oscillating here, and I can basically drop the k eta here, and you find that the phi is modulo and overall modulation in time are oscillating like that. But so that's when the modes are inside the horizon, they're oscillating like crazy, but as inflation goes on, the modes go outside the horizon, you go into a region where k eta is much less than unity. And in that region, the field, phi plus k, splits the leading contribution, as so you're going, at late times, its eta goes to zero because of the weird math of the coordinates. So as you go to t is plus infinity, eta is becoming small. As eta becomes small, it's now the second piece inside the bracket that dominates. This goes like 1 over eta. That cancels the overall eta here, but as k eta becomes small, I can also drop the exponential. And so that's the limit in which the actual field becomes a constant, and furthermore, it becomes a constant with the famous k 3 half spectrum, which makes it a scale invariant. So the field in that limit, instead of oscillating, it becomes a constant. And in fact, if we were a little more careful, and we compute the next order correction, you might think it comes in at order eta because of this piece, but in fact it comes in at order eta squared because there is a cancellation between the eta piece from here and also the eta piece you get from expanding this out. And so the second order, next order piece in the expansion comes in at order eta squared. So in that limit, the late time limit, the field splits up. The leading contribution to the field is basically a constant, and then there's a subleading piece that actually becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. And this is often, in the literature, this is referred to the growing mode, even though it's constant, and this is called the decaying mode. And that notation is such that in general it will be in cosmological perturbation theory in general, whether we're looking at the scalar fluctuations or the density fluctuations, at long wavelengths, when your modes are well outside the horizon, the solutions will always split into two solutions, one of which will be growing and the other which will be decaying, where by growing we really mean it's the ratio of these two things is actually growing in this case. This field is actually constant, but for other variables it'll actually be explicitly growing. Now we could have seen this, we could have anticipated all this by going back to the original scalar under sitter, writing down the equation of motion in the standard FRW coordinates, where you would find that it looks like phi double dot plus 3h phi dot minus spatial gradient phi e to the minus 2ht is equal to 0. What we're seeing is that in the limit, when we're at long wavelengths, when k eta is much less than unity, that's equivalent to saying I neglect the spatial gradient terms in the equation of motion. That's what happens at long wavelengths, and I just have these time-dependent pieces. Now, this equation is actually very easy to solve. One solution is a constant. Because the field doesn't enter into this equation without a time derivative, it's obvious that a constant is one of the solutions. And the other solution is easy to get as well, because we can write this as log phi dot dot is minus 3h, which is minus 3 log a dot. Well, actually, that's a constant in this case, so let me just write it like that. And so we get that log phi dot is minus 3ht plus log of a constant. Did I do that right? Did that right, yeah. And so then we can say that phi dot, we can write it as c e to the minus 3 ht, and then phi splits when we integrate that. We get a constant plus something that's decaying exponentially in time. So that's the growing mode and the decaying mode of those two solutions. And the point is that then, in this limit, it's also true. So every field should be split into two modes. But in this limit, the field just becomes a constant as the modes go well outside the horizon. And then the complex conjugate of the mode in that limit, phi k plus star, is basically minus phi k plus, because the overall thing is a constant with just a phase in front. And so it's equally true, just as before, although we can't really assign a value of beta in this case because we don't have a well-defined notion of particles when the modes are well outside the horizon, what we can do is still say that what's happening is that because one of the modes is decaying away, it's essentially like saying the original complex field should always have two components, real and imaginary. But in this limit, one of those just decays away, and so both the real and imaginary part are... there's only one independent guy in this limit, which is actually this pure imaginary part. Therefore, the complex conjugate of the wave function is determined in terms of the real part of the wave function. And in that limit, it's true that phi xt... phi xt eta prime, that expectation value goes to 0. And so that's what we mean. That's what people will say when the modes go well outside the horizon, they become classical. And that's all we mean, is that in that limit, well outside the horizon, the fields begin to commute, basically because of that discarding of that second mode. The complex conjugate is determined by the original mode. That's the process by which the classical probability distribution that you use to start your post-inflationary evolution to, as a seed for gravitational fluctuations. That's derived, although inflation, the actual calculation is fundamentally a quantum one. You calculate the inflationary fluctuations in a quantum state. What you then take at the end of inflation is a classical initial condition for the subsequent evolution, because what's happening is that classical field correlate, the quantum field correlator becomes classical as the modes get stretched out to the horizon. And that's some, so it's somehow the process of inflation, the process of particle creation, is precisely what makes a sort of quasi-classical universe out of your original quantum one. And that's, so there's no picture of wave function collapse or anything like that here. That's that squeezing process because of the particle creation is how our classical universe comes out of the original quantum one. Okay. So tomorrow we'll continue, we'll really start going into the details of inflation and then starting to see how to apply all the stuff we learned about quantum field theory and co-space-time and how that actually applies in the real case of inflation and not just these idealized cases of scalar fields in interstitial space. Okay.